Hey guys, welcome back to another podcast on Hashtag Woke Settler. I'm your host, King of Seagon, and today we will be discussing residential school experiments. Before I talk more about the residential school experiments, I'd like to inform you guys about the history of residential schools. Residential schools were created by Christian churches and the Canadian government as an attempt to both educate and convert Indigenous youth and to assimilate them into Canadian society. An estimated 150,000 children attended these residential schools, and an estimated amount of 6,000 children unfortunately died at residential school. In total, over 130 residential schools were operated in Canada, being the first one made in 1831 and the last one closing in 1996. Overall, the Indigenous students had a very negative experience at residential schools, one that have lasting effects on their lives. The Indigenous students were isolated and had their culture ripped away from them. They were removed from their homes and parents, and they were separated from some of their siblings. The schools were segregated according to gender, and they were forbidden to speak their first language. They couldn't have their first language spoken even in letters sent home to their parents, and they were also given new names. Indigenous students performed more labor and work than learning and getting an education. The tasks were separated by gender, as the girls were responsible for housekeeping, while the boys were involved in carpentry, construction, general maintenance, and agricultural labor. Overall, the Indigenous students received a poor education at residential schools. This was true both in the terms of academic subjects and vocational training. Students had to cope with teachers who were usually ill-tempered, mean, and unjust. The lessons were taught in English and French, languages that these children were unfamiliar with and did not speak. In the workplace, the teachers were often harsh, and the supposed training purpose of the work was limited or absent. Moreover, the attempted assimilation of Indigenous students left them disoriented and insecure, with the feeling that they belonged to neither Indigenous nor settler society. Many students suffered abuse at residential schools. Impatience and correction often led to excessive punishment, including physical abuse. In some cases, children were heavily beaten, chained, or confined. Some of the staff were sexual predators, and many students were sexually abused. When allegations of sexual abuse were brought forward by students, parents, or staff, the response by the government and church officials was, at best, inadequate. The police were seldom contacted, and even if the government or church officials decided that a complaint had merit, the response was often simply to fire the perpetrator. At other times, they allowed the abuser to keep teaching. Finally, on June the 11th of 2008, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, on behalf of the Government of Canada, offered an apology to all former students of residential schools in Canada. The apology openly recognized that the assimilation policy in which the schools were established was wrong, and that it had caused great harm, and it has no place in our country, Canada. The apology recognized the profound damaging and lasting impact the schools had on Indigenous culture, heritage, and language, and was one of the steps that the government has taken to forge a new relationship with Indigenous peoples in Canada. Also, on November 24th, 2017, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also formally apologized to the survivors of residential schools in Newfoundland and Labrador. With informing you guys of these facts, I'd like to invite fellow Ian Mosby, a food historian and postdoctoral, to the stage.
Welcoming us tonight. I want to start by also saying how honored I am to be on the stage tonight with the other panelists. I think you're all in for a real treat, and so I'm going to talk as try to keep my comments as brief as possible, but because I think what everyone else has to say is far more important, and I'm really looking forward to having a dialogue on the impact of these nutrition experiments, but also having a dialogue on what truth and reconciliation really means in Canada. And so, as you all know, we're here to discuss the legacy of a series of nutrition experiments conducted by the Canadian government during the 1940s and 1950s. So I thought I'd start my presentation by going back to April 1952, when Dr. Lionel Bradley Pett, one of Canada's leading nutrition experts and the director of the Federal Nutrition Division, stood up before the American Institute of Nutrition in New York City to present a paper entitled "The Development of Anemia on Newfoundland Enriched Flour." Pep began his presentation by outlining the details of a 5-year study examining the effects of feeding fortified white flour with added thiamin, riboflavin, niacin, and ground bone meal to students at an unnamed boarding school in comparison with students at a similarly unnamed control school. The results Pep informed the audience were disappointing. Blood tests showed that the children at the experimental school quickly developed iron deficiency anemia for the duration of the study, while at the control school, the hemoglobin levels of students actually saw some improvement. The conclusion, according to Pett, was not simply that the experimental fortified flour mixture offered no benefits to students and may in fact have actually caused the anemia that he observed. For Pett, the much more important conclusion was that given the unexpected results of the study, more studies like this one were clearly necessary if scientists and policymakers alike were to really understand the effects of adding chemical additives like synthetic vitamins to our food supply. As Pat explained to the audience, the actual proof of whether or not fortified foods were truly safe or beneficial typically required, quote, tedious physiological studies. Unfortunately, he argued, such studies are, quote, often omitted or are confined to certain animal experiments rather than to humans. He concluded then by suggesting that, quote, the benefits or hazards of adding chemicals to foods cannot, in the present state of knowledge, be judged on theoretical grounds or limited animal experimentation, but need physiological testing on human beings. Now, of course, what Pett neglected to mention to his New York audience was that his experiment on the Aboriginal students of the St. Mary's and St. Paul's Indian residential schools was made largely possible because of his access to a population of chronically malnourished and vulnerable children whose wards of the state had little say either in the quality of their diet or whether or not they participated in the study at all. Nor did he mention that the success of his study depended on the fact that the so-called controls and experimental subjects were being fed diets known to be nutritionally inadequate for anywhere between 2 and 5 years, or that they were being actively deprived of certain elements of their basic dental care so as not to interfere with the experimental data being collected. Nor did Pett mention that these were just two of a much larger series of nutrition experiments being conducted by the federal government between 1942 and 1952. These experiments, as we now know, included, among other things, a double-blind, controlled, randomized study of the effects of vitamin C supplementation on malnourished children at the Shubenacadie School in Nova Scotia, an examination of the effects of both inadequate and adequate milk consumption on a population of children with clinical signs of riboflavin deficiency at the Alberni School in British Columbia, an examination of the effects of something called vitamin B, Canada-approved vitamin B flour at the Blood School in southern Alberta, and in the early 1940s, a controlled experiment examining the effectiveness of a range of different vitamin and mineral supplements in the treatment of acute nutritional deficiencies in a number of subarctic Cree communities facing widespread malnutrition and even starvation. Now, while most of these studies, ostensibly at least, involve some therapeutic value, it's important to note that none address the broader range of nutritional deficiencies that inspired the experiments in the first place. Instead, they focused on much more narrow, technologically based interventions that they hoped could later be applied to the problem of malnutrition both on reserves and in residential schools alike. And in the case of the residential school experiments, these researchers actively withheld certain medical treatments from the students. For instance, when Dr. H.K. Brown, one of the leading researchers on the study and the chief of the Federal Dental Health Division, discovered the dentists actually visited some of the students in the experimental schools, He quickly sent off telegrams and letters insisting that for the duration of the study, quote, no specialized overall dental type of dental service should be provided to the students. Brown argued that because cavities and gingivitis were both, quote, important factors in assessing nutritional status, that any significant dental interventions would impact the results of the study. Students at the controls, or at the experimental schools, in other words, were denied treatments that pupils at other residential schools would have had ready access to for the duration of the study.
Wow. I'd like to thank Ian Mothby for that wonderful speech of his. I'd like to thank him for coming here today and giving us a deep thought and explanation about residential schools. Personally, when I heard Ian Mothby's speech, I thought to myself of how cruel people could be and how sick the world is. I wondered to myself why people would stoop low to experiment on children, innocent children, who have no idea what's going on. I just hope that me revealing these things to you and having Ian Mothby talk to this to you, that you guys understand that the indigenous people, the children, they went through a lot. And it's because of these things of why they suffered up to now, why they have trouble connecting to their culture and their traditions. They cannot get over the fact of the horrible things that were done in residential school. And so, I ask for all of us to try and be grateful. And we should understand that these indigenous people, time cannot always heal, but it's how we go about being with them. I just hope in the future that the indigenous people, their traditions, their cultures can reconnect again and they can be truly happy. I hope that the government can at least give them justice and have them explain to the indigenous people and also apologize for experimenting. I know they've already apologized, but I would like them to also apologize on the experiments and give reason and thought on why they experimented on their children. And with today, guys, I'd like to conclude this podcast and thank you guys for listening. I hope you all have a great day.